Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, if you're a network engineer, an IT consultant, or computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Jerry.
And I'm Andy.
Yeah, you got it all right.
This is episode 13. And I was just thinking before, now one of our first episodes we were there and we were saying it was the hottest day of the year. It was absolutely sweltering here in England. And now we're hit by this weather bomb, as they're calling it on the news. I mean, what is a weather bomb?
I've never had a weather bomb before. Destruction.
to me, it's just windy and raining.
Yeah, it's not been...
So it's very cold up there, Andy, or...?
Yeah, it's been pretty cold, mainly windy, but a lot of rain, hail.
But it's cold enough here that you can leave the beer outside instead of putting it in the fridge.
That's the only useful part about it.
So we're going straight into the show tonight, aren't we, guys? So we had an email in from
a letter. Sounds like Sesame Street. This. Today we had a letter. The letter is the letter G, and number 3. Yes, we've had an email. Should we go ahead and read it out?
Andy?
I'm going to read it. Yep, it's a fairly lengthy email, but you'll see why in a minute. Okay, it says hello, long time listener, Simon Cornish here. Long time, well, 13 episodes at least, but excellent. Firstly, thank you for having spent a lot of time researching and putting together the Admin podcast. I've enjoyed every one. Like others who have commented, I like how the show is presented by the people who actually do what they're talking about. I've worked with Al, number one, in the past, and have a similar background to him. That I have worked and still do work in an environment where I and my colleagues are supporting window domain servers, desktops for other businesses. I've been presented with a problem recently that I'm hoping you can help me solve, or perhaps any of your listeners may know. The problem is this: one of our customers has a Windows domain with 5 domain controllers. They are a mix of Windows 2008 R2 and Windows 2003. The 08 R2 box that is running the PDC emulator role is configured to get its time from a Cisco iOS device running NTP. It's been doing this successfully until recently. I can see the problem starting in Event Viewer on the 5th of November. In testing, I found that if I pointed the PDC emulator at the Windows domain controller, it is successful in getting the time using NTP. So at first, I pointed my finger at the Cisco NTP device, but I'm reliably told that there are other Cisco devices on the same network that are getting their time from that NTP source. So I did some more testing and found that one and only one of the domain controllers could get its time from the Cisco NTP source. So I looked to see the difference between the successful domain controller and the PDC emulator. What I found was that the successful box was the only one of the 5 domain controllers that was itself not configured by an NTP server. So I set the PDC emulator to stop serving NTP, and after restarting the time service, it immediately started picking up time okay from the Cisco box. He goes on to say, I can't leave the PDC emulator in that state. The main machines need their time to stay in sync. So I have told it to be an NTP server again. And this means the domain machines are all in sync, but the domain has no higher authority to collect it from its timeform. My next test is to try to connect the PDC emulator to an NTP source on the internet. This will help me work out whether the problem was with the NCP source or the PDC emulator. I'm waiting for UDP port 123 to be opened on the firewall so I can test this. And depending on the answer, I'll be raising a call with Microsoft. But I can see already who they are going to blame. Despite it seeming to be fixed by me telling the PDC emulator not to be an NTP server. It goes on to say, oh, and the domain controllers are VM machines, but have all been told not to pick up the time from the host that they are sitting on. I am told they can ignore this setting, but it seems to be a feature that at any reboot, they may still look to their first host. But even this does not happen. The hosts are themselves configured to look to the same Cisco NTP device. So have any of you come across this before? What tests haven't I thought of? Finally, would you be interested in doing a show about NTP? I feel I know a bit, but I could benefit from more than just reading Microsoft TechNext articles and Wikipedia. Thank you for making it to the bottom of this long and involved email. And that is from Simon. Well, that was a long email. Where do we start?
Well, he actually solved his own problem, so we've got him to come on the show to talk about NTP. Hi there, Simon.
Hello, long-time listener Simon Cornish here. thank you for having me on. The first thing I need to say, actually, is that I am on call this evening, so I could be rudely interrupted by my phone, which is currently on vibrate.
I hope you get to answer the question first, Simon.
Yeah, I know you're all on tenterhooks. So yeah, I hope I don't get halfway through the answer and get dragged away. And I'll keep you on tenterhooks for a bit longer if you like, because I thought I'd hijack the show for a bit and turn it into a show about NTP, or at least part of it. So can I tell you what I know about NTP and then what I did to fix it? Is that all right?
Sounds good.
All right, let me just find my notes, because I carefully prepared this in my head. And then I thought, that's not going to work, I need to do some notes. Right, so I'm only talking about time in terms of Microsoft Windows, because that's pretty much all the exposure I do have to it. So if any of you have got experience outside of that that contradicts anything I'm saying, let me know. So the Windows Time Service is there to keep machines on a domain in sync. And they can do this using a couple of protocols. 10 years ago, or more, I think it was exclusively SNTP, so Simple Network Time Protocol. And then they got more accurate with this and introduced support for NTP, Network Time Protocol, which is used throughout the internet to keep devices in sync. Simple Network Time Protocol isn't regarded as accurate. I think that machines on a domain using only that protocol can be as much as 15 minutes out without any problems, whereas NTP talks in terms of kind of hundredths of a second. Microsoft themselves state that their implementation of NTP isn't guaranteed to be accurate, but still, if you look at computers on a domain these days, it's kind of rare for them to be more than a minute out. And in my testing over the last couple of weeks, I found that they generally are within 1 or 2 seconds of each other. So although they're not guaranteeing that it's accurate, it's still at least a lot more accurate than 15 minutes. And the reason that it's important to have computers to have their time synced isn't just for convenience for us, but also because there's a bit of a security hole in having computers that don't have their time in sync, because it's possible, apparently, to replay previous authentications. So packets that have been transferred throughout the network and being allowed to log on and see different resources can actually be sniffed out, those packets captured, and then replayed again. So to prevent this from happening, there's a system in place, Kerberos, which will prevent from this from happening if it's not happening at the right time. So you can't replay old packets. So to stop that from happening, all the clocks on the network have to be more or less the same. I don't know whether any of you guys have come across this, but for instance, a NAS device that has LDAP integration, if it's not configured itself to update its time when the British summer time kicks in and the clock goes an hour out, you'll find that it can't allow people to log on to it.
That's how Kerberos works, isn't it? We've mentioned in the previous show that how it encrypts a packet at a certain time, and that's why they have to be at the same. So when it gets the other, then they can decrypt it at the same time.
Yeah.
So that it can.
I've had a situation, if I've seen someone's machine, this is a common one, home desktop. Now if the battery on the motherboard is going a bit naff, is going a bit crap. They go away on holiday for a couple of weeks, and when they come back, the BIOS has reset and the time's gone back to 2002 or something, they then switch the computer on, everything appears to work, but it causes absolute havoc. There's things like you go online onto a browser, and website certificates aren't working because because the time's wrong, and also as well things like antivirus definitions and things like that causes chaos with them, because all the definitions are of 2014, but the time it's trying to connect from is 2002. So it can cause chaos in that respect.
So in summary, computers need to have very similar time to each other. And so out of the box, a Windows domain will look after itself completely. If you've got one domain controller on your network, it acts as the NTP server for the rest of the machines on the domain. And it's done in kind of a hierarchical fashion. So if you have more than one domain controller, then it's the domain controller that has the PDC emulator role. So it stays with a hierarchical fashion. So you'd have the PDC emulator at the top of your tree. The other domain controllers then get their time from the PDC. And all the client workstations on the network get their time from one of the domain controllers. And it will be whichever one is their logon server. So whichever one authenticated them onto the network in the first place. And the Windows domain can stay in its own little bubble and get on fine, and there won't be any of these security Kerberos issues. And theoretically, you could set your PDC to have a clock of 3 days ago, and you could be in your own little time bubble from the rest of the world, and there wouldn't be any problems. But it makes sense to configure your PDC emulator to get time itself from an accurate source on the internet. And so you need to go open up a command prompt, type in W32 time, and some commands that then set it to so it knows where to get its time source from. And I'll add those commands plus some other ones in the show notes. Now the problem that I was having was that actually the as described in the email, the lengthy email, is that the this customer's domain actually has a Cisco box that's acting as a time server. And then it itself was going out to the internet to get time. And that had been working absolutely fine for years, actually. I don't know what it was about the 5th of November that caused there to be a problem. And here comes the big reveal for the fix. What I stumbled across a TechNet article eventually that said that if you are connecting to a non-domain machine, a non-Windows domain machine, to get your NTP time, you may need to specify to connect in client mode. So it was simply a fact of adding four characters to the end of a string to tell it to connect in client mode for it to successfully work. And then everything was happy. So I was relieved, but it was almost a bit of a letdown to find this. And the article was written specifically for 2003, but it worked very well on this 2008 machine.
How does a time... So the Windows client, so they've got a Windows 32 service running on the machine, and that's what gets the time from the main its logon server. Is that how it works? Or
yeah, so we can call it a Windows time service in normal English language, and the executable is W32 time. And it itself can support NTP and SNTP. I think it falls back gracefully if it can't get its time accurately using NTP. And it, I think as well, again, it's Windows XP and Windows 2003 onward that by default use NTP. So that's when things became more accurate in the Windows world.
Cool. So you're saying you need to set your PDC to get its time from the internet, but you need to tell it that to get its time from the internet, you have to put this special code in, which is basically telling that to act in the client mode. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, I've done these things by registry, and then I've since found out that you should never, ever set time things by registry, and you should just use the W32 time command. Oops. But there's a key in the registry, essentially, that gets added to say NTP server is, and then your answer might be pool.ntp.org, which is a set of servers out there.
Yeah.
And what you need to add to the end of their registry key, if you're being naughty and doing it by registry, is so the full line would be pool.ntp.org, (0x8). And that 8 is the bit that says I am connecting specifically in client mode. And that doesn't need to be there if you're connecting to another Windows domain machine. And most of the TechNet articles, even when they're just talking about NTP and not a specific operating system, they only ever talk about the Windows world, so they don't mention it. They just happen to stumble across a forum where someone was having a similar problem, where they did find a TechNet article that specified what you do if you're connecting to a non-Windows domain NTP server.
Yeah, because I never set that thing before, but we have had issues in the past where you have set it and the time has skewed. So I'm wondering that's what you have to do. You have to set it up with that thing to tell it to go and collect its time from the internet using that command.
Well, if my time spent explaining this helps anyone else, then I'm pleased. The other thing is allowing UDP port 123 open on your firewall. You won't be able to connect to an external NTP source if that's not open.
Yeah, I had that. A client of mine, they've got these Raspberry Pis doing their monitoring on some sites, and they noticed that one of them was about a year behind the others, and it wasn't really causing any issues other than the updates were a year out of sync that this monitoring box was doing. So yeah, I did some investigation and found that I couldn't update the clock via NTP, and it was because UDP port 123 was blocked. So blocked at the firewall.
So Jerry, do you want to speak about, you were talking about before pre-show about the NTP and reflection?
Yeah, there's just something I'd heard about a while back was just a little security nugget really about how NTP can be used if certain things aren't configured. It can be used to basically direct a lot of data at a host on the internet. So this would be more of your a server on the internet, not necessarily an enterprise that's behind a decent firewall, but so what happens is an attacker, I'm actually basically reading this, the technical details out, but here we go. An attacker can send a packet from a forged source IP, so you can basically say the IP is not the IP that you're actually sending it from. And the thing with UDP is you've got a short amount of data in the question and a large amount of data in the answer. So if you say that that source, that forged IP, is the person you're trying to attack, then you can get that data going towards your intended victim. And you can also have that, you can forge other IP addresses so that you get lots and lots of hosts basically sending data to the victim. I think I was reading about this attack that generated 400 gigabits per second, which is a fair amount of UDP traffic just pointed at this poor network. So, yeah.
It's the same with DNS reflection tests, isn't it? Where they, I didn't really understand it until I found someone who had an open DNS. Well, because we're going back to DNS. If you have a DNS server on the internet and you set it, I can't remember what the mode is now, but where it's like it responds to any request. So normally you set up a DNS server just so that it responds to the records you host, but you can actually set it up so that it responds to, like, if it's like an internal DNS server. And if people, what you can do is you can spoof where the IP address is coming from, and obviously just keep hammering these requests. And obviously the DNS server is not going to send a request back to you. It's going to send it back to whatever the spoof's IP address is, and then obviously that's where the DDoS comes from. So what other people have been up to then? Have you had any interesting stories at work this week or anything you come across?
Yeah, so... I had a call off somebody. This is in a home. It wasn't in a business or anything. So they've just got two standalone PCs. And the guy was trying to do this himself. And all he wanted to do was do some file sharing between the two computers. But he couldn't figure it out. And he couldn't get it to work. Now... of course, when I got there, I've got to figure out what he's done. You know, what has he actually done first before I've got there? He didn't know a whole lot. He was just trying to do stuff and never got it working. But what I found was he had actually got... He was running a BT hub. So that was his first point of call. But connected to that BT hub in another part of the house, on the end of an Ethernet cable, was just a normal Netgear router. So what he'd done is he'd plugged in the output from the BT hub, and he'd put it into the WAN port on the Netgear router at the other end, and then he'd then plugged the local computer at the other end into one of the four ports on the Netgear. So after I saw that, I thought, right, we know what's going on here. It's basically got two DHCP servers running. So the BT hub was on 1.254 was the default gateway, and the Netgear router was on 10.0.0.1. So as a result, two different subnets, and that's why he couldn't. That's why the Windows machines couldn't see themselves over that network. So basically, what I did was I use the term, I dumbed down the Netgear router. So I turned off the DHCP, and I just give it a static IP address that it would, you know, to connect to the BT hub. And I also put the cable from the BT hub, instead of into the WAN port, I put it into the one of the four output ports. So that's a long story, but in the end, that's all it was. So. I mean, there's some of the things that we've covered on previous shows, isn't it? The DHCP and things like that. So, there's a practical story of something we've already talked about, which all worked out in the end.
I had a router that it was it wouldn't give out, I think it would give out a DHCP address, but it wouldn't give out router or DNS, which made it pretty useless. So I put in a Raspberry Pi to do that job with DHCP and DNS and so on, just to get around the limitations of the router. I think the router, I don't know, it screwed up somehow, but I couldn't get on the internet, basically, so I had to put a Raspberry Pi in. And now I've got a new router, and I kept the Raspberry Pi. So
you doing anything interesting this week, Jerry?
Yeah, I've been doing stuff with the email. I wanted to, a couple of shows ago, I sort of floundered a bit when I was trying to explain public key encryption, but I found quite a good kind of analogy on the net. This was at security.stackexchange.com, and makes it quite easy to understand if you think of I was going on about those two keys, there's a public key and a private key. So if you think of the public key as a padlock, basically, so you're sending a padlock to the receiver, and then the receiver locks the information or encrypts the information with the padlock, and then only you, the sender, can open that padlock. So that's basically explains about how the encryption works, and that's the way it can work the other way around is if you give everyone the key and you have the padlock, then anyone with that key can open the padlock so that they know it's your padlock then. So that's just a bit of an easier way of explaining public key encryption. Where this comes into what I was doing this week was there's a standard with email now called OpenDKIM. I don't know if it exists in the Exchange world, but it uses public-private key to basically guarantee that the mail is coming from the server that it says it's going to. So you configure the key on the server, and then you have a DNS record, a TXT record with the public key, and you have the private key on the server. So when the receiving mail server gets the mail, it can go to that DNS record, and then it can check that the two keys match up, basically, and it's basically a spam fighting measure. So I was setting that up for a client who is sending mails that he didn't want to be spam filtered. Not a spammer, I should hasten to add, but he had valid reasons. That's part of what I've been doing. Same client, actually. He's using Plesk, which is a server control panel. Maybe we'll talk about those in another show. But he's using an older mail server called Qmail, and to get this DKIM stuff working, we decided to go from Qmail to Postfix. Postfix is more of a kind of industry standard mail server, and mails from sent by certain people weren't working, so it was just a configuration in Postfix which is saying basically encrypt everything, encrypt passwords, I think, or encrypt authentication, and the fix for that was just to say use authentication if it's available, if not, don't bother. There's a bit of that in the show notes, so if anyone's interested. So
we had kind of an interesting thing, didn't we, Jerry? Oh no, Andy, about the you had a problem with the WSUS, didn't we? We were just trying to work out why your client's all the computers couldn't connect to his WSUS to pick up its updates.
That's right. Yeah, we're trying to figure that out, weren't we? What was going on? We were trying to get there's a 2008 server, and then there's about, how many is it, eight or so Windows 7 machines. And we're just trying to configure updates, weren't we, for them? So to push, you know, to download the updates and push them out and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was a 2008. It was SPS 2008, wasn't it? Server.
SPS. That's
so
you've, right.
It's
yeah.
got the WSUS, but it's also got the like the GUI on front of it, the Mickey Mouse kind of front end of it to configure it. So yeah, it looked like that was downloading all the updates correctly, but the PCs weren't getting the updates, were they? So we did a bit of research on it. We found out that, first of all, the group policy was not being applied for some reason to the actual PC. It looked like the policy was there, but the computer section, which was meant to be applying, like, tells it where the WSUS server was and when to apply the updates wasn't getting applied. So I went about 10 minutes trying to work out why this wasn't being applied. And I remember previously I was saying about that how you mustn't, if you wanted to, by default, because all group policy apply to all the authenticated users, you shouldn't remove that authenticated user from that default box. You should go into the security settings and basically untick the box that says apply. So it says that all authenticated users can read it, but they can't apply it. So what happened next was we did all that and we added the users in. So we added in the computer account, which we wanted it applied to. But again, I couldn't see the group policy being applied because I was running GP update, or sorry, GP results /R, but it wasn't returning this thing, and I was getting really confused. And then I remembered that it was only showing the GP update or the group policies being applied, which were the user group policies, not the computer. And there's a command you have to run, which is GP results /R/scope/computer, and that basically tells it to show you the computer, what's being applied to the compute policy on the computer level. And it was showing you the updates. But then we found out there was two other things, that when none of the computers were showing up in the WSUS console, and it was because you'd cloned the machines, haven't you, Andy? So they all had the same SID.
It was all my fault. It was, but I was going to say that's obviously the mistake that was made in the beginning, because I cloned them. I mean, I was trying to be clever, you know, but so I'd made one, cloned the hard disk to then re-image onto all of the others. So what did you say when we were doing it? You said there's something I could have done.
Yeah,
I
can't think of the command now. You can sysprep the machine. It basically puts the machine back to factory settings. It basically resets the SID, and it also Windows update was replying. So what was happening is that one machine was reporting in WSUS, and then it would say, oh yeah, this is PCA1 reporting with this ID, this special number, and then PC2 would come along saying, yeah, here I am, this is my ID number. So it was missing PC1, and then PC2 was coming in. So there was a nice article on the on one of the websites I found, can't think of what it is now, and it was basically there's a command, like a power script someone had written, that he said basically a PowerShell script or a bat script, which basically reset all the settings up. Reset all the WSUS stuff back to the original settings, so that when WSUS was talking to the WSUS server, it would register itself properly. So we'll put that into the show notes. But then we had another problem, was that it was then registering WSUS, but it wasn't done in the updates. So a good place to check is in the Windows directory called Windows Update Log, and it basically shows you in there what's happening. And in there, it was saying that it was basically saying a self-checked fail error 0x800B001, warning digital signature on file C Windows software distribution / software update WinUI det cab are not trusted. So it was because the Windows Windows 10 machine had a later version of the Windows Update client compared to what the update version or the WSUS server was, wasn't it? So I left one with you to try and figure it out. But did you get any further with that? Or
well, when I left you, we downloaded the 64-bit version, didn't we? And then that failed. And then you had to go off, so I downloaded the 32-bit version, and that failed. So we're on the right lines, but I don't know why that failed. But it was quite late at the time, wasn't it? So I didn't progress on with it. So that's where we're up to at the minute. So we'll probably have news of that in a later podcast when we get that fixed. We also had a hard drive problem, and I haven't actually physically been down there yet, but we had a hard drive problem as well, didn't we? Because we were trying to set up a backup.
We got some updates to install on that server for the Ws, or the whole updates for the server. So I'm guessing if we can install the updates on that server, that will hopefully fix that issue. But we wanted to do a full backup first before we got it. And then you had a hard drive, what the customer is using, which he took out of a PVR machine, which is a 2 terabyte drive. But whatever we did to format it, it would not format it. We were creating new MBRs on it, using FDisk to create it, but it would not. I can't remember what the exact error message was we were getting. Can you remember what it was, Andy?
I just remember this drive cannot be formatted or something really helpful like that. but it was it was a drive. The customer had bought this DVR for CCTV cameras, and it had been in that machine for a period of time, supposedly recording and working quite normally. Now, one point here is, of course, we don't know what that was originally formatted in for the DVR recorder. We assumed, as I think they're all in some kind of Linux format, aren't they? But that was a previous format, so it's supposedly working fine. But when we were kind of updating stuff and we were taking stuff out and taking drives out, and I thought, right, this 2 terabyte drive will be great for doing the backups on this SBS server. So that's where it's come from. I mean, it's acting like it's got a fault, doesn't it? It's acting like there's a problem with the drive, but I just don't see it. But the next step we've got to do, as you suggested, was to pick up the drive. I'll bring it back with me and try and format it here instead of in the server itself. At least make it NTFS, would that be the best one to do?
Yeah, I wanted to bring it back, just boot it on a Linux distro and use something like Departed to see if we can see if anything hidden on that drive which we're not seeing in Windows.
Yeah, it could well be. I think there's some kind of partition thing. I don't know. I haven't physically been down there. When I go down there next, I'm going to pick the drive up. It's just a 2 terabytes in a USB caddy, you know. Maybe the caddy's got something to do with it. I don't know. We'll have to try that. But I was also asking as well, is there any kind of terabyte limit with backup drives or 2008?
No, because the only problem you get is if you got the boot partition, it can't be bigger than 2 terabytes. It can be. I can't think. It is if it's what's the new disk format. So you got MBR, which is that's correct.
Yeah.
But for you, GPT, the boot controller's got to support it. The servers or the it's got to support it, doesn't it? You can set it to GPT, but again, you have to make sure that the peak. I had a server the other week which I was trying to set up a thing. Oh yeah, I can get past this 2 terabyte. I'll set it to GPT. Set it to GPT, but unless your server use it GPT, then it won't.
I think there is a bit of a workaround for that where you put like a few, like a sector at the beginning of the disk, and then you can address the rest of the disk. But you don't need a full-on boot partition. Yeah, you just have a tiny little bit of data at the beginning of the disk.
So what's that new BIOS thing like you get with all the new laptops and stuff? Because that will do the GPT, I can't think what it's called. And there's like loads of issues with Linux
EFI
with it.
Or UEFI,
that's
it.
That's it.
The UEFI, yeah.
Which I've never come over. I haven't had a chance to play with
all yet. My computers are really old, so I've just got normal BIOS.
So, have you got anything to say, Miss Simon? Have you got any other interesting stories you've had this week?
Sorry, I was furiously Googling some, because I thought that there was a tool built into Windows for getting past some standard GUI formatting issues. And I couldn't remember what it was called. I had all these terms in my head I was Googling for, and none of them were coming back at all. Like FPart or FTDisk or something, but none of them were coming up.
What tool were we using? Was it FDisk?
We used DiskPart.
That's it. We're using DiskPart. We basically. So yeah, that was my next call. But we couldn't do it. So, but this brilliant thing in Linux called Dparted.
I've used that. Yeah. I've even used it on a remote server, just displaying back to my PC because I needed to. Basically shift a partition over or add a new partition, and it's just so much easier. I mean, you could do it all on the command line, but something like that, you just want a graphical interface. And
yeah, I want to basically just put it into a machine, get it on an Andy's machine and sit in his Linux VM and see what we see with it, really. So
yeah.
Have you been trying out some new Linux distros there?
Manjaro. I stuck it on my computer in this room, actually, not the computer I'm sort of broadcasting on at the moment. But as soon as I get a webcam, I will be. I'm gonna go full Linux podcasting at that stage. But Manjaro. It's really. I mean, it's based on Arch, which I talked about in the first show I was on, which is. It's kind of bit more hardcore Linux distribution, but Manjaro, it's really easy to use. They may have talked about it on Linux Luddites, but it's really quite polished. You just I just stuck it on a USB key, told it to install, told it basically to not overwrite my existing partition where I had all my data. Just installed. I came back half an hour later, and it was ready to go. So. It's really good. By default uses XFCE as a window manager, which is nice and light and clean and everything. But you can put different, whatever you want on there, apart from sort of Ubuntu Unity, I think. But
yeah, I like XFCE. That's what I've used on all my Linux desktops. I tried Manjaro for a little while, but I'm still going back to Ubuntu.
I mean, I'd heard good things about the package manager. There's lots of different packages to choose from. I suppose there is with Ubuntu as well, but I don't know.
Is it called Yogurt or something?
I think it's Yaourt, which is French for yogurt, isn't it? Yaourt.
Yet another. I think it stands for yet another something.
AUR is the Arch User Repository, which is the where they stick all their software. But yeah, I'm planning to put it on my downstairs computer, the computer under the telly, because hopefully it'll be a bit faster and won't fall over as much. So yeah, I'll keep you posted, listeners.
Good. I'll have a quick chat. About sites and services in Active Directory after my last talk. I was talking last week.
Do we need a pencil and paper again?
No, there's no pencil and paper this time. So sites and services are another way of distributing. Well, it's two purposes. One is to help users log on to the network to find the domain controller. And the second one is to tell it to how to replicate information between domain controllers. So let's just say we have one domain in a forest, so it's a single domain, single forest, but you've got two sites, but you've got two physical sites. You've got one in UK and one in France. And you, so you've got two domain controllers at each site, and you want everybody in the UK to obviously get the UK domain controllers to be authenticated by the UK ones, and the ones in France to be authenticated by the French domain controllers. So you use this thing called Active Directory Sites and Services, and what you do for this is you basically, first of all, you create the sites for your site. So you create one for the UK and one for France, and in there you can, there's one that's basically, when you first go into this program, there's one called a default first site name, which is basically all the domain controllers in it. And what you do is you, from there, you drag the domain controllers from there into the correct folder. So you just drag them and put it onto the UK one and drag it into the USA one. And then what you do is you create subnets. So you'd create a subnet for each site. So let's say you had a 192.168.2.0/24.4 the UK, and then 192.168.3.0/24 for the French people, or the French site, and then obviously there are going to be different subnets and different sites, because obviously there you'd hopefully got a WAN going, you haven't got extended LAN between the two. And then from then, you on that subnet, you'd right click and tell properties, and you can basically attach it to the site, to the site. So you'd assign the UK one, the UK subnet 192.168.2.0/24 to the UK site, and then the 192.168.3.0/24 to the France site. So this basically means when the user logs on, it looks at what its local IP address is, and it goes out and find out which is nearest the main controller, and it will then it uses that one to authenticate itself against. I don't know how it goes off and chooses, because I'm guessing it's going, it must, I wonder if it sets something in DNS what defines what that setting is. I'm not sure, I have to have a look at that. And then if you think about it, if you say you've got the UK and the French site, you haven't got a great link between the sites, so let's say you've only got a really small VPN connection through those two sites. Is that, obviously, if you create a load of user accounts or something, or computer accounts, or change security accounts, you don't want that all that information going over the wire at the same time. So what you want to do is you want to set up like a replication schedule. So like it does it once every 1 hour to 4 hours. So what you do is you create a thing, because there's a thing called inter-site transport. And let's have a look at my notes before we go at. So yeah. So you basically create sites, so if they are in the same, like I said, they're in the site name, which is we called UK, they will basically transmit the data, I think it every 15 seconds. So intra-site communication, so that's the site between, so if you've got two domain controllers in the UK in the same site, which we're calling UK site, that will basically transmit that data between the two sites every 15 seconds. And if you have a look in, if you go into the domain controller and you click on NTDS settings, it will automatically generated this, will happen every 15 seconds. But then you've got a thing called intra-site thing, which is basically, it happens by default every 3 hours. And what you've got to be careful is you can also, you can set the link between the intra-site things, you can actually set up a link cost. So what you could have is, I should have got you to draw this, but you've got like a triangle, and you say you've got three sites, and you've got between A and B is, let's say, sorry, I'm getting confused here. It's getting late in the day. I've written something down which doesn't make sense. It's always good.
So is this similar to least cost routing? Is that a term, yes, that you put there?
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think how it works. It's like you can be careful. You can kind of cut yourself up into, because you can basically say like it will basically just choose the quickest. No, I'm not going to say anymore because I'm confused now completely. I'm going to have to look at that more.
So I think that some of this was put in place because I think the examples in TechNet articles are kind of between Seattle and, I don't know, Washington and New York or something. And you might have quite an expensive lease line at one of the sites, or it might be really slow. So you might choose replication to go between New York and Seattle, and then between Seattle and Washington, rather than going from New York to Washington directly, because that link might cost money, for instance. So in sites of services, you could set up those three subnets, drag the servers in as appropriate from each of those sites, and then you could put a longer or a slower replication time. Does that make sense, or am I mixing two things up?
No, that's correct. So what I'm saying is, when you create, because automatically generated is automatically generated by when you create the sites for the inter sites, the intra sites, it automatically generates it and puts it everything the same in 15 seconds. When you put it in to an intra site, it creates it 3 hours. Whereas what you're saying, you might not want all your traffic to go, as if you, like as Simon says, that it goes between three sites. And what you can do on that, you can obviously say how often you want it to replicate, but you can then also say what the cost of that link is, so that it will calculate which is the best route, the best link to go between the three sites.
So the sorts of things that are replicating, I mean, the only thing that I can think about is Active Directory updates. So if you change a password on an account in New York, because domain controllers do all sync their list of accounts, that information will also be replicated to the domain controllers and the two other sites. Actually, I realise I'm talking about New York and you were talking about UK and France earlier, so sorry for mixing it up. But it isn't that important, is it, to have a password replicated over to the other site all that quickly, is it? Because that person's not going to be logging on at that site. So you want it to happen eventually, but it doesn't need to happen immediately. So you don't want a load of traffic going every 15 seconds over sort of lease lines or ADSL connections, do you? You just want that to be going quickly over the domain controllers on the same site.
It's also like if you create a load of computer accounts or something, or you put a load of users accounts, they have to be all obviously transmitted across the wire. It's more in the old days of Windows 2000 when you had it all slow ISDN connected between the site. We had a slow connection to a country which hasn't got very good internet connection or WAN links, and that's why it happened.
I
was just going to say, my employer uses AD replication for DNS, so for the global DNS infrastructure as well. So interesting.
And I was wondering about Exchange as well, because there's a topology there as well that I think follows sites and services.
Yeah, I think that's in case with 2000 and 2003, but 2003 and above, it changes to something else. Because I remember someone saying about the work this week. Because you've got global catalogues, which you have to require, don't you, for it to know. If we work to Exchange, it has to know how to get global catalogues. I think the mail flow as well, doesn't it work with Exchange 2000, I think 4 or 5.5, is that it uses sites and services to work out where your mail to be delivered.
Yeah, that's right. I can't remember how tied in the most recent versions of Exchange are to sites and services. I've been reading a lot recently, and I need to go back and read it again because I might have been confusing two different technologies. But things like database availability groups, even. I think you can have two servers sat next to each other in the same building and then one in a different building. And the replication is very quick between the two that are near each other and then not quite so often to the one that's further away. Does that use sites of services to know that?
I think so. I think the same with DFS as well, doesn't it? That's how it works with how it gets its gets where it find out where its closest DFS resources. what its partner is.
Let's do some more homework.
Yeah. Homework for next show. But no, I want to just basically just say about sites and servers. I need to, obviously, I don't understand it as much as I thought I understood it.
So, I get like that when I'm trying to explain things on the podcast. I think, oh, I didn't actually look into that too deeply, did I? So
obviously, I'm not ready for that exam question yet. But if I could dial into a server and have a look at this, the screenshots, it's been good. But, right, okay. Well, we're getting near the end of the show, I think. Where's...
Yeah, where are we up to now?
About 57 minutes, according to the thing.
We're nearly there. So, does anyone get anything to wrap anything up? Or
one thing I did want to ask you guys was about it's just about Windows Home Server. I know it's kind of defunct now, but did it become Small Business Server Essentials or something like that? But it was just something that I noticed. I never used it or anything like that, but it just looked quite interesting to me as a kind of sort of server OS, and it did this kind of you could stick multiple disk drives in there and it would do some kind of replication, not RAID, but some kind of software level replication. So do you guys know anything more about that? Or?
I've heard people speak about it. I never used it. I know you can do things like you can sync it up so that if people save their documents or whatever, or their pictures, it replicates it to the server.
Yeah, it kind of did back up all your Windows PCs on your network, and it was kind of joined into, was it home groups in Windows 7 or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
I haven't done much with it, but I'm guessing there's a cut down version of the domain. So.
Yeah. Okay. No, I was just curious. I thought you.
I don't think it's about anymore. I think they've discontinued it.
No. Yeah. But I think it became like Small Business Server Essentials. But I guess you're doing more sort of enterprisey type stuff.
Yeah.
Active Directory and so on. So cool.
So we're coming to the end of the show, and we're going to obviously get in there Christmas, and we thought we'd have a bit of a Christmas special show next week. We're going to have to say we're going to do we record this on Google Hangout, but we thought we'd like do it live. So if you want to come in and watch us and talk to us in the chat while we're doing it, we thought it would be good. So that'll be episode 14, won't it?
Episode 14, and that's it. We're looking at doing it next Friday, aren't we? So
which is the 19th.
So
GMT or BS? I was guessing it's December the 19th.
UTC, isn't it? GMT is the same as UTC for all you international
listeners.
So 9
o'clock UTC, we have our Christmas special. You can come and watch us live if you want to.
That'll be 4 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central. 3 o'clock Central. In case everyone...
You're doing a Leo Laporte there, Andy.
Yeah, confirm it yourself. It will be December the 19th at 9, I suppose it'd be 2100 UTC, wouldn't it?
To be 2100 UTC,
to be precise. Okay, we've got a bit of a special thing we're going to do. We won't tell you what it is until you join us on the show. So thanks for coming on, Simon. It's been great to hear your questions and how you fix your own problem. So
can I ask a question?
Go on.
What happened to the competition?
Well, you will find out next week on the...
I see. And can I tell you a nerdy joke that I heard today as well?
Of course.
I'll probably stumble over it now. It's only a one-liner, so if you don't expect a punchline. The thing about UDP jokes is that I don't care whether you get them or not. And thank you for having me along on that note.
Good. All right, and well, as always, you can email us at mail@adminadminpodcast.co.uk. Actually, we had another listener email in, didn't we, just saying thanks for the podcast and that it's helping him with his server homework or server networking, wasn't it, or something along those.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, he's a student, wasn't he, or something?
Yeah. you found us by the Mike Tech Show, so we obviously are getting out there. So, so you can email us at mail@admin@admin.podcast.co.uk, and we'll see you all soon.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.